Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 142 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Group Captain Chunky Duck.
I'm Squadron Leader Skinny Hayden.
And I'm Wing Commander Foxy Mark.
We're back, listeners, after a little bit of a pause.
Yeah, they're partly my fault because I had to move into Paradise Towers for a short spell, which is where I'm joining the chaps from today. Yeah, so if you hear any banging about in the background, it's probably just Pex living.
In 4 days' time, it will be Doctor Who Day on the 23rd of November, and Doctor Who will be 57 years old.
God, almost as old as you, Doc.
Thank you. Happy birthday to William Russell, who is 96 years old today.
Ooh. Nearly as old as you, Doc.
Even as we speak, we are planning our regular Christmas Diddly Dum podcast. I must start preparing that, the gold run for that. We were thinking of doing a Pertwee-themed Christmas podcast, weren't we?
My friend Nick, who watches Doctor Who occasionally and listens to the podcast.
Is this Nick with the dodgy microphone jack?
Yes, it is. Yes.
A headphones jack, yeah. Rather.
Yeah. We were having an online conversation last night, a group of us, and...
Hang on. You have other friends?
Well, you know.
I've told you about this. And what happened, sorry?
And he started saying, oh, yeah, what podcast are you on now? It's the I watched that one with Stephen. You watched what with Stephen? And then he said, yeah, no, that's what I was going to say. And then he just made up, he said, I want you to do a podcast of the top 10 Stevens from Doctor Who. I did think, oh, we could do a Feast of Stevens, couldn't we? And do the Diddly Dum's top 10 Doctor Who Stevens.
What on earth did you want us to do that for?
Well, he doesn't. It was just a random thing that came out of him garbling his sentence.
I can think of three off the top of my head. You got Stephen Taylor, Stephen Wyatt, Stephen Gallagher.
No, don't spoil it.
Stephen Moffat.
I mean, we don't necessarily have to do the whole thing themed around it, but it would be nice for to slip in a top 10 Stevens.
Well, there are at least two in Green Death. Stevens.
Or we can do, yeah, we could do 10 questions on Stevens and call it the Feast of Stevens. Who was controlled by the boss? Stevens, right, correct?
Oh, yes.
That'd be good. Yeah. We can do that.
Yes. So we must do that next year.
Now.
Thank you, listener, for attending this AGM. This Diddly Dum AGM.
I suppose we could do a Pertwee-themed working titles game, couldn't we?
Oh, yes.
I can't think of any other ones we could theme to Pertwee.
We could do one about monsters called Carnival of Monsters. Or we could do one about bad moments of special effects and call it colour separation overlay.
I reckon that if we put our mind to it over the next couple of weeks, yeah, we could come up with stuff for a Pertwee themed one.
I mean, give me this weekend and then I'll have quite a lot to...
Well, if you'd like to arrange some higher or lower questions for Play Your Cards Right, Mark.
Yeah, I could do it. I'm sure I could do a Pertwee themed one of those.
We can't really do a Pertwee theme for the gold one. That'd be far too complicated.
No. That's immutable.
Talking of John Pertwee, who was it who said recently how notable it is, how little of the John Pertwee era, if any, is rubbish? Was that you, Hayden?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, because I just finished the John Pertwee rewatch. Yes. It's possibly the most consistent era from start to finish of any Doctor's run, where there's possibly one bad story in every season, apart from one or two. The rest of them are thoroughly enjoyable the whole way through. Even with Tom Baker's run, you know, you can pick holes in that. Graham Williams era. But Pertwee's lot... quiet at the back, quiet at the back. But with Pertwee's lot, it's amazing the whole way through, unlike the era I've just revisited and just finished. Oh, God.
But it is effectively run by Barry and Terence all the way through, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
For the whole 5 years. Mm. So there's at least there's consistency there. And they are those two are people who are competent. I don't mean that to sound rude. But Terence knows what he's doing as a script editor. Barry knows what he's doing as a producer.
I feel as though we're going to be coming on back to this question later.
So I understand you then went on to do a Colin Baker rewatch, Hayden.
Yeah, and actually, do you know what? I obviously started with the Twin Dilemma in season 22, and I had three very significant and almost... You couldn't make it up. You couldn't make it up, right? I watched The Twin Dilemma. By the time I got to episode 3, the disc got jammed in my Xbox player. And I took it out and I saw there was a huge scratch on it. I thought, okay, I'll try it in another one.
Oh, when you said that the disc had got jammed in there, I thought you meant like you couldn't get the disc out and it was stuck in there forever. And if you ever wanted to watch a DVD or anything on your Xbox, it was always going to be The Twin Dilemma, like some kind of weird curse.
You know that cine footage that Carol Ann Ford did of them doing the Dalek Invasion of Earth?
And yes.
She'd done it on a film of her playing around with her dog in the back garden. It would always be like that, no matter what I'm watching on the telly. The Twin Dilemma would be burnt into the image. The image was getting jammed on the screen, and I took out the disc, and there was a huge gash through the CD. I thought, okay, that's weird. Tried it in all the other DVDs, didn't work, so I gave up on that. Attack of the Cybermen went through absolutely fine. Vengeance on Varos, that was absolutely fine. Mark of the Rani, to get this one working on my machine, I had to reinstall Blu-ray Reader on my Xbox One. It just wouldn't work. It was really bizarre.
It broke your machine.
Two Doctors I haven't got anymore, but I've seen that relatively recently, so skip that one. Went to go watch Time Lash, and the disc was missing. It was like the universe was telling me not to bother watching the Sixth Doctor's run. It was incredible. So this is what? I mean, he's only got 8 stories at the best of times. For me, 3 of them are either missing, unwatchable, or were breaking my machine. But anyway, no, I ended up... funnily enough, I found Time Lash in the Revelation of the Daleks case along with the Revelation DVD as well. So I finished off season 22. And I have to admit, chaps, I watched The Mysterious Planet, the first 4 parts of Trial of the Time Lord, and thought, I can't do this. I can't justify watching this again. And I think partly it's because the Blu-ray box set, only came out about a year ago. So these all still feel quite fresh to me. Also, for the fact I can't stand Mind Warp. I hate that story. I really do.
It's been such a long time since I've seen it. I'm going to wait until we have to do it for the podcast.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, for me, I mean, I can speak about Trial because I have watched it relatively recently. I have to say, actually, and I listened back to our episode when we talked about Vengeance on Varos, and I thought, I was possibly a little bit too harsh on it. Not in my review, but my mark. I think I'd probably bump it up from a 6 to a 7. It's a pretty good story. As soon as they leave the TARDIS, it's actually a really good Doctor Who story. Revelation's really good. I enjoyed Revelation.
I remember enjoying Revelation at the time when it was on television.
Yeah, I thought Revelation was pretty decent. Bits of Mark and the Rani I thought were all right. But the only trouble is, I think that's really it for me. It's not... We'll leave it for when we do the Sixth Doctor's era, but you know, I was pleasantly surprised with bits. Even Attack of the Cybermen was more watchable than it has been in the past, so I was fairly happy with that.
Yes, it's a pity when you have ears, isn't it, where there are very few decent stories. You can't really spend that much time talking about them, can you?
Not really.
So what's coming up next?
That's why I'm trying to think of more things to say.
We've all got digital copies now of the new, I suppose it's an anthology, a collection of all the Dalek stories from TV Century 1 that came out. Was that part of DWM or was that more a BBC magazine?
Yeah, it was a Doctor Who special by Marvel.
I was hoping that I'd be able to get a hard copy one, but they seem to be almost impossible to find, except for people who bought them up and now are flogging them for a fortune on eBay.
Yeah, I think they appear to be in random supermarkets.
Oh, right.
So if you go in supermarkets, have a look in the magazine racks in there, because that seems to be where most of the people I've seen online have found them.
But if either of you finds one, buy it for me, would you? And I'll pay you back.
Yes, certainly will.
Because you've got the 90s one, haven't you, Mark?
Yes, I have. That one with the Dalek Emperor on the front cover, flanked by two Daleks advancing on the mechanoids.
It does rather remind me of these Blu-ray special collections that come out, where they say, we'll do a limited edition. Mm. Which is guaranteed to make sure that a lot of people were left disappointed by it.
I know. Yeah. Although you say that, but season 12 actually came back out very briefly on, I think it was Zoom, was selling some copies again,
yes.
Season 12, this week, so.
Yeah, I've just looked on eBay for the original Dalek Chronicles, and somebody's trying to sell a copy of it on there, the Dalek Chronicles collection, as it was called. It's the UK Marvel one, and £124.99 they want for it. And they also would like £6.99 postage on top.
Oh dear. I got a little jammy on eBay the other day.
Oh God.
Oh, how unusual.
I've been looking up some of the action figures, and I purchased a River Song one for £4.99.
All right.
But guess how much of that cost?
But when it turned up, it was actually Alex Kingston.
But guess how much of that £4.99 is the postage and packaging?
£2.99.
No. £4.79.
So technically you got it for 20p.
Yes.
Probably cheap if you'd said, don't post it, I'll drive around and pick it up from your house.
Well, no, this is the thing, it's coming from Hong Kong. So.
Oh. Right.
It probably would still have been cheaper for you to drive around and pick it up from Hong Kong.
Yeah, so who knows? Maybe one day it will turn up, maybe it won't. But at least if it doesn't, I've not spent too much on it. But I did make Mark proud, and I purchased the Lala Ward Romana incarnation in her Naimon costume.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
But it reminds me, this Daleks thing, of that Trigon Empire thing that came out last year. For years, the only way you could get collections of that, you'd get quite thin collections that might have, a couple of stories in. And they're about £70 or something. I'm never paying that. And suddenly they do a complete run of them.
Yeah.
And it's only about, I think it's about less than £20 or something. And they've done it, I think, as they've done with this Daleks collection, they've gone back to the original artwork, haven't they?
Yeah.
And taken copies of that rather than, as often you'll sometimes find when you buy a collection of comic strips online, it looks as if they've just photocopied old comics with them in, doesn't it?
Yeah, when they used to reprint them in the Doctor Who magazine, some of the reprints were terrible, weren't they? Especially when they did the black and white.
Yes, reprints. It was black and white, wasn't it?
You couldn't tell what's going on in half the frames. It was really sad.
I'll tell you what, I have a few collections like that. Obviously, the first collection of the Trigon Empire, but I do have the, not many of them, but some of the Doctor Who anthologies, so like The Iron Legion and Endgame, The Glorious Dead, that kind of thing. But they look fantastic. But the ones that I was most blown away with are the James Bond Daily Express comic strips that went out in the 50s. I've got three volumes of that.
All right.
Which are glorious, rescanned from the original artwork, beautiful. But I've also got the Frank Bellamy, Gerry Anderson stuff from TV Century 21, back in the 60s, going through from Fireball XL5 all the way through to Joe 90 in a compendium. with like Lady Penelope and like the Angels as well from Captain Scarlet had their own comic strip. And they are beautiful because they're in colour as well.
Yeah, and a lot of them were painted, yeah, weren't they? So it comes up, they look beautiful.
I was going to say, but some of my old Beano some of my old Beano collections are clearly just photocopied from the old pictures to the point you can see like the coffee ring stains on the on the paper. Yeah, wonderful stuff. I'll have to have a look at this. I haven't owned it up yet.
Hayden, you were maundering something about Scratchman the other day, weren't you?
Yeah. I mean, obviously at the moment the libraries are shut here in the UK. But recently I bought myself a Fire Reader from Amazon because actually, funnily enough, after our comics episode, we had so many PDFs of the old stuff that it was just impossible to book them out of the Hooseum anymore. Especially with, some of the older issues, pages falling out and, So I thought I'd help out my local library by registering with the online provider. And through that, I've been able to, read certain books. I've just finished Another Thing, which is the sixth Hitchhiker's book. But they do audiobooks on there as well. And the first audiobook I plumped for was Scratch Man. I noticed they had last year, so I gave that a read.
Read by Tom Baker?
Read by the man himself, yes.
Oh. Well, I mean, let's face it, it'd be a waste of time. If Tom Baker's written something, it'd be a waste of time to get some other actor in to read it, wouldn't it, really?
Yeah. When you said, I thought you'd go, Yeah, I mean, it was fairly hefty. It was like 8.5 hours long, I think. So I split it up over a few days. And I didn't know much about this. I knew that obviously this was from an idea that both Tom and Ian Marta had, and they wanted to adapt it into a film, didn't they, I believe, back in the day. And I thought it was pretty good. I don't think it would have worked as a film, really.
No.
And it just about works as a novel, and I think it only works in its current state because of the man himself has written it and because he brings so much to that book. It's funny because there's bits in the soundtrack when he's kind of laughing along and you wonder, is this bit in the book or is it just is this him going off script and laughing at something that is written,
Is this also, is this partially helped along by James Goss?
It is, yeah.
I mean, he's got relatively good form with doing that era of Doctor Who, or of doing Tom Doctor Who, hasn't he? In novel form, because he's done he did The Pirate Planet and he did City of Death, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he's very good, I think, at capturing the voices of them the characters from that era. So bits of it do feel extremely Tom-like, but I don't know if that's because James Goss has got very good at impersonating Tom. I don't know how much. Yeah, I'm not denigrating Tom's writing at all, but it's definitely, because there are appearances by other characters from Doctor Who who aren't from that era who appear in, and certainly that's not going to be Tom's work, is it, I would think.
I mean, he must have been okay with that idea, otherwise it wouldn't have gone in the book.
Mm.
But I actually quite enjoyed those little touches, there are other incarnations appearing in this book.
Mm.
Multiple, we should say. And I actually quite liked how he dealt with them, because I sort of got from that. I mean, it always feels to me like maybe Tom had a bit of a rivalry with Pertwee a little bit.
Mm.
They never quite saw eye to eye, I think, when, the few times when they did do conventions, I think Tom used to wind him up by saying rather loudly, oh yes, I'm doing this advert and they're giving me this much money. And then it would make John Pertwee run to the phone and call his agent immediately saying, well, Tom Baker's getting this, so why aren't I getting this much? It was quite, I presume that's friendly banter. I don't know, but...
I imagine it was slightly more, it wasn't quite as easygoing as the Pertwee and Troughton relationship, which got very, very close, didn't it?
It did, and it was nice to hear, because I was being a bit of an idiot, because I knew in the back of my head that Ian Marta was a part of the initial story outline for this. So, of course, Harry Sullivan would turn up. But I didn't expect it to be that TARDIS team of the Doctor, Harry and Sarah. in this book.
I think they're written really nicely, aren't they? That those opening scenes with them on the beach and stuff, it's having their picnic and
playing rounders, aren't they?
It's absolutely delightful. Yeah, Harry and Sarah Jane are captured beautifully. I mean, I think it feels less like that as the book goes on because it...
Mm.
Well, he manages to maintain the characters, but they're in such bizarre situations later on that it feels less like that era. But, I could read a book about that TARDIS team just going around and having picnics and playing rounders and nothing particularly happening. Yeah. I could read whole volumes of it, to be honest.
I'll tell you why I thought I didn't think it would work as a film, though, is that it is very focused on that core TARDIS team, to the point that some of the other characters, the secondary characters, feel very two-dimensional.
Mm.
It feels like the Doctor, Sarah and Harry are fully fleshed out, whilst, you know, the Time Lords who are in it feel quite generic. Scratchman himself feels a bit... There's nothing that really differentiates him from another...
He's very comic book...
Yeah, he is, yes. Yeah, yeah. And some of the residents of the small Scottish island as well can feel a little... they seem to be quite atypical, I think.
Hmm. I could imagine that this Scratchman working really well as a long comic strip, actually.
Yes, yeah, you're right, yeah. Yeah, but as a film, I'm not certain this ever possibly would have got made anyway. But I think... Tom Baker brings so much to it, especially in audiobook form, that it...
Oh, yeah, I bet.
It's got enough to keep you ticking along. And James Goss, like you said, he seems to have a knack to bring the best out of that era into prose form.
Mm.
So I feel as though... I think it works, yes. It does absolutely work as a novel. I was quite pleased it was on there. And I've moved on to Sting of the Zygons now by Stephen Cole, which is a 10th Doctor and Martha story.
Okay.
Looking forward to finishing that at some point.
At this point, faithless listeners, Doc got a phone call from work and had to disappear, leaving Hayden and Mark to chat idly about various tangential issues.
I'll tell you about these other figures I've managed to pick up fairly cheaply. I've got the Brigadier from The Claws of Axos.
Okay.
I got Perry in her Two Doctors garb, so when she's got like the headband and the spangly jacket.
Yeah.
I got Romana from the Pirate Planet.
Which one's that? Is that the pink jacket?
Pink jacket, but everything else is white. That's the closest I could get to the white dress.
Oh.
I know.
Oh, right. Man. And I mean, both white dresses are great, but the Armageddon factor white. Because obviously the... What's the first one? Rebos Operation.
Rebos, yeah. Isn't it
an amazing... I mean... that's going to make us sound like old pervs on the outtakes of this. But that shot panning up Mary Tam when she's standing there in a dress is just like, oh my lord.
It made me think, you know, looking at these though, it's like they really, like, as Doctor Who fans, I think the look and the style of the companions are actually fairly iconic.
Mm.
Because, I mean, if it like the Martha Jones action figures, her in that brown leather jacket.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I think of when I think of her. And like even like the Amy Pond ones, like the mini skirt and the red t-shirt and the denim jacket,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Harry Sullivan with the duffel coat. And
I don't know. They, a lot of these ones seem slightly off, the figures. Because a lot of the time they're made out of figures they've already got moulds for, aren't they?
Oh,
so they've got
repurposed. Yeah.
Some of them have the jackets from people in Primeval and things like that, I think.
I didn't know that, have they? I'll tell you the one which really stands out for me, though, that I've got is a Bill Potts.
Oh.
With the stripy tank top and bow in the hair and, you know, those Marty McFly trainers that she wears. I think that one's fairly nice, but...
Mm.
I didn't realise that there's two variants on Sergeant Benton, isn't there?
What, is not a naked one?
There's Baby Benton. And there's him in the khaki Terror of the Zygons, in the greens.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's one of him in more of a sort of formal wear, I think, from sort of earlier in his run.
Well, I'm not going to be happy until I've got Benton and Yates in their demons costumes.
Oh, what, the turtleneck? But I'm absolutely... I'll tell you, my favourite one I've got so far is the Sarah Jane Smith from Genesis and Revenge of the Cybermen. It looks so good, that one. And it also, considering the Tom Baker figure I've got is him in the with the red jacket from season 12. So to have him, Harry and Sarah, it looks properly in sync now. But there's so many they haven't done. They haven't done any... Well, they haven't done any of Hartnell or Troutman's companions. There's no Liz Shaw.
No Adric.
There's no... there's no Fifth Doctor companions. And there's no Mel. There's no...
No, there's not Nyssa either, is there? So
No. Which makes me wonder, I reckon the BM... I wouldn't surprise me if at some point the B&M collector sets, they will do one with Ian, Barbara and Susan, I reckon. And then I also reckon I'll do one of Adric, Nyssa and Tegan as well in their season 19 gear.
Maybe. I don't know. It's just the thing is, if it's not with a Dalek, like they've done the Ace with a Dalek, haven't they?
I really want that.
Yeah.
I really want that. Yeah.
But I don't know if the other ones... would. I mean, Fourth Doctor is such a good seller. Compared to most of the other Doctors, as far as classic Doctors go.
And as ever, you'll find links for more information on almost everything that we discuss on the podcast at our show notes on our podcast blog, which you can find at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. Right, well... get on to the main topic of today, which is...
Oh, hold on, sorry, can I just... I just need to open up a can of Fizz-Aid. Oh. Ice hot! Oh! It's ice hot!
This time, we finally got around to one of our retrospectives, in which we're looking at the Blaxploitation era of Doctor Who. Yes, when they were pursuing the Cartmel Master Plan. Yes, it's Sylvester McCoy's Seventh Doctor's era. We have a clean break with a brand new script editor in Andrew Cartmel, who is bringing in new writers and a set of very different types of story ideas. As always with our retrospectives on each Doctor's era, we invited you on social media to send in your votes for your top 5 Seventh Doctor stories, and as usual, every story which someone voted in first place received 5 points, second place is received 4 points, third place is received 3 points, fourth place is 2 points, and stories placed in fifth place received 1 point, and we totted up all the points. And would you believe, there's a first, not a single story received no points.
No.
In the Seventh Doctor's era.
Surprise me.
What? Seriously?
Yeah.
Okay. What?
The one story did receive only 1 point.
Was it Time in the Rani?
How did you guess? Now, back in Diddly Dum, the early years, in 2014, Andrew Cartmel guested on our podcast, number 16. So we'll be including some clips from that podcast here and there, hither and yon, to illustrate our chat. I didn't watch these as they were being broadcast. I know Hayden didn't. Did you, Mark?
I watched... it was very patchy for me because this was at a time after Colin Baker's era sort of really turned me off Doctor Who. I still kept my hand in occasionally, so to speak, and watched just the odd couple of episodes here and there. But I very rarely watched an entire story. I think I watched all of Remembrance of the Daleks, perhaps. Yeah, and then I think I caught up on some of these a bit later. I think I must have seen some repeats on UK Gold. Don't think I brought any of them on video. So a lot of these I hadn't seen all the way through at the time. And some of them I haven't really caught up with since. I'd say most of them, apart from the ones we've reviewed for this podcast, I haven't watched in over 20 years. So it was very much coming to this with new eyes, because I did hate this era at the time. I just hated it. I found Sylvester McCoy lightweight. The whole production and everything seemed very plasticky. I do wonder sometimes if that's how older fans felt about season 17 when it came on, which I loved because I was younger.
Not just older fans, Mark.
So it was. It's always been an era that I've not looked forward to revisiting, to be honest.
Until now. It's interesting because I think I've said on previous podcasts from when we've done McCoy stories, so I'll make it brief, but you sort of grow up absorbing stuff from Doctor Who magazine or whatever newspaper or whatever you read, like whenever there's a little bit of Doctor Who in there or Radio Times. And the consensus during the 90s was that the Seventh Doctor was the one who killed off the show. And there seemed to be, I felt during that time growing up, like the McCoy era and also the Colin Baker era were no-go zones for good Doctor Who, which of course wasn't the case. You know, that there's going to be good in every era, no matter what you think of it. There's always something to enjoy in there. But the only McCoy story I had on video during that decade was The Happiness Patrol. And it completely went over my head, and I hated it. I really didn't get on well with it. I used to watch it because my sister enjoyed it for Ace and for The Candyman. But I just thought, nah, this isn't for me. This isn't, come on. He looks like Bertie Bassett, for Christ's sakes, you know. It wasn't until the DVDs started coming out, there was a bit more of a reappreciation. And I think there was a link between the Russell T Davies era of Doctor Who and the McCoy era of Doctor Who, where you could see like a running thread. And you could see where this was starting to go and where it, I mean, it might, you know, it could just be where television was going as well.
The episodes didn't feel quite so standalone. They actually felt like there was consequences almost from week to week. You know, that they were kind of designed to go in that order to a certain extent. Whereas, obviously, with a lot of the earlier eras, you know, they felt very much more like standalone stories, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I felt as though it wasn't a reappraisal as such, because I hadn't seen a lot of these before, but when I started seeing them, I could definitely see the good in them, and I could see where some of them, why they were regarded as classics. I mean, it wasn't until, I think it was DWM 260 or something or other, where they did the first ever rundown of the greatest Doctor Who stories, and Remembrance was, I think, eighth in that list? Really high. And I remember thinking, well, it can't be all that bad then. I think, you know, there were some from season 26 which were really high up, not quite in the top 10 as well. I thought, oh, this can't be all bad then. Of course, it isn't. But I definitely remember in the 90s not wanting to sort of go there with the, you know, the man, the comedian with the umbrella, but then just discovering over the decades that have ensued that, you know, there's so much more to him than that. And we shall delve deeper.
Yeah. The other thing for me was, at the time, because I was about the same age as Ace, I think.
Mm.
And she was written by these sort of middle-aged men to be this cool, modern girl. And it just came across as being incredibly, well, as Ace would say, it came across as being mega naff. And also at that time, when you're sort of in your late teens, you do start getting incredibly serious about things.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And so while I was in the 80s, I hated most of the 80s aesthetic. I didn't like it at all. I didn't like...
Well, it isn't a decade that's aged particularly well in any genre, is it?
Well, it has its own fans, though. It has a group of people. Yeah, I think Rob Irwin was commenting the other day. Somebody was saying about how great Tegan's outfit from Resurrection of the Daleks was. And it's so incredibly 80s, and they're going, this is an amazing outfit. And Rob quite rightly pointed out that, yeah, that sort of thing might look cool now from this distance if you're like really into like 80s retro stuff.
Yeah.
But when you're there at the time looking at it, you're thinking, God, that's awful. and I think that kind of stands for certainly the way I felt about the show at the time when I was watching it. It felt so incredibly...
Well, you were both of an age where you were moving away from the show. You know, your eras when you'd grown up, this show was so fully removed from them now. You know, it's totally different. There's not one carryover from the Tom Baker era. that goes into the Sylvester McCoy era. Nothing, you know.
All the production staff, well, pretty much most of the production staff, directors are all new, aren't they?
Yeah, the script absolutely.
Writers.
But you're also moving on with your lives during the late 80s, where, you know, Doc's at university and you're, you know, you're in your band.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're not going to be, I'm in nappies. So we're all, you know, very far removed from Doctor Who at that point.
No, I didn't watch it, the Seventh Doctor's era at the time it was broadcast, or the Sixth, actually, because I was at university and probably getting too old for it. I might have caught the odd episode or two here and there, but largely everything I have seen of this era would have been seen at least 5 years after it was broadcast on UK Gold Omnibus broadcasts. And I do appreciate that if I had been a kid when I was watching this on broadcast, it would have been easier for me to like it. But I don't really think that age entirely explains why Sylvester's era does very little for me. There are huge chunks of Doctor Who which I didn't see until I was in my late 20s. All of the Hartnell and the Troughton eras, pretty much the first half of the Pertwee era, most of the post-Tom stuff, actually. So why don't I think as badly of the stuff I missed pre-Logopolis as I think of what I missed post-Logopolis? And I can only think it's the difference in the way they're being written and performed. There are Hartnell and Troughton and Pertwee stories which I don't rewatch. Time Monster, things like Fury from the Deep, The Chase, because they bore me, not because I think they're poorly done. Well, The Chase maybe. And there are distinct changes. For instance, no one thought pre-Logopolis that the Doctor's companions should either resent him or be plotting to kill him.
Yeah.
So there's clear changes there. For me, when Doctor Who manages to be powerful, the power doesn't always lie in the story idea. In fact, it rarely does. It lies more in the performances. The performances, the characters, the dialogue. They're what drive the power of any entertainment, and particularly of any meaning that there might be behind the stories.
Mm.
And we're told in retrospect, aren't we now, that Seventh Doctor era stories were full of social and political commentary. It's just that we didn't realise it. I think it's funny that, was it 2010, that they announced to the media that actually while we were doing this, we were trying to use Doctor Who to bring down the Thatcher government. And you see a lot of the comments online saying, ha ha ha, how stupid the BBC were not to realise this was going on under their noses. The thing is, it wasn't going on under their noses. I think it's a lot of rather self-congratulatory, pretentious nonsense. I think there's more effective political commentary in Invasion of the Dinosaurs than any of the Seventh Doctor era stories. And Doctor Who isn't Dickens. It's not Shakespeare. It's not James Joyce. It's not William S. Burroughs. It really isn't. And I don't think it's useful to try to pretend they are in order to interpret them that way. And so I rewatched the whole Seventh Doctor's era when Andrew Cartmell guested on the podcast. And I made a real effort to find something I liked in them. But when I'm watching them again this time, this is partly one of the reasons why it's taken so long since, between our asking for your votes and actually doing this podcast, is I just couldn't bring myself. If there'd been, you must watch Remembrance, or maybe Curse, in order to prepare for this podcast, it wouldn't be too bad, but it's, you must watch. Well, it's very easy to find, shall we say, more pressing engagements than to say, I'm going to sit down and watch Delta and the Bannermen tonight. I mean, I'm not particularly keen on things like The Leisure Hive. Doesn't entertain me that much. But I wouldn't dread having to watch it and keep putting it off.
No, but that's more your era, isn't it? And it's also,
yeah,
there's more to go on with other Doctors too. You know, which I think is why we feel, and we may, I mean, actually, for the first time since we've done this, I did just have a look at the spreadsheet, and I've instantly forgotten what order they all came in, but I'm fairly certain we'll have the Usual Suspects will be near the top, and the Usual Suspects will be down the bottom, and that's because we've only got 12 stories to go from. So we've already seen Fenric, you think, oh, well, I haven't got a nice surprise to see now, because I've only got, there's another stories there, you know. It's interesting, though. It is interesting.
Well, I have to say, I like Doc was...
Oh, thanks, Star. That's very kind of you.
At least one of us does.
Goodbye. He's going to clip that and play it over and over again. I like that.
There's a line in Handel's Messiah, quoted from the Bible, which is, we like sheep. We like sheep have gone astray. And if you know how the Messiah goes, it constantly repeats lines and keeps, you get a choir going, we like sheep. We like sheep.
Where was I?
I like Doc, he's much better. So you're about to say that, like me...
Like Doc, I really wasn't looking forward to watching through the three seasons of Sylvester McCoy at all, and it did seem like quite a burden. And it became like some really difficult physics homework that I had to do at school. and like my really difficult physics homework, I sort of left it until the morning of the day it had to be handed in before I did it. So in the last 4 days, I've watched all three seasons of Sylvester McCoy. And I did worry at one point that this is, I think certainly during Paradise Towers on the first day, I was thinking this could leave me permanently damaged psychologically. But oh my God. Then something happened. I don't know what it was. Some sort of weird Stockholm syndrome kicked in. And I just found myself getting absorbed with it.
What?
And I found myself utterly, utterly enjoying it. And I couldn't wait for the next episode. It was coming out with totally fresh eyes. And suddenly I got it. It just all made sense. Yeah. I just thought, this is great. I'm really enjoying this. Even the slightly, well, even the very crap ones. I mean, not Time in the Rani. No offence to Johnny Dabb, who rather likes it, I think. But I just... As it went on, I just think this is bizarre. This is so unlike the Doctor Who that I usually watch now that it's almost like watching Doctor Who from a parallel dimension. It suddenly seemed really fresh. Mm. I mean, not necessarily well put together all the time, but it does have a lot of ideas going on in it. And there's so much going on. I absolutely loved it. I've had such a good time these last 4 days watching it.
Oh, brilliant.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Complete revelation.
Have either of you seen the episode of Friends starring Brad Pitt?
Yes, years ago.
Where he comes back, and when he and Ross were at high school, they formed the I Hate Rachel Society.
Yeah.
And he comes back and he's furious to discover that Ross is now in love with Rachel.
Mm.
I feel almost like that. I mean, well, it's not the first time, obviously, that I've been compared to Brad Pitt. But,
oh, dear.
I think it was halfway through Delta and the Bannerman. It just suddenly all seemed to...
No, I'm joking, of course. I'm really happy for you.
He says as he dials for medical assistance.
Nurse! Nurse!
Yeah.
So you were around about what, Delta?
Yeah, halfway through Delta and the Bannerman, I was so enjoying it. I was laughing. I mean, towards the last, during the last series, I'd even got used to the awful version of the theme tune and those opening credits. And I was smiling when Silver McCoy turned up. I was winking back at him.
Oh, the sex wink.
I was winking back and smiling away.
We don't need to apologise for that. I was laughing through much of this too, but it was mostly with in hysteria.
I think you're so cruel.
Well, no, it suddenly totally makes sense, and I'm now worried that I'm going to have to go to because I do have access to a library of the complete new adventures, and I may have to start digging in. McCoy's definitely gone up in my opinion as a Doctor.
Gosh. Well, I must admit, I'm glad, really, because I was thinking, oh, dear, it'll be... We don't want a podcast which all three of us are dissing Sylvester's era, because, one, we'd just be using up each other's store of vituperative language. And two, it's really boring for the listener, especially if it's someone who's quite keen on Sylvester's era. I mean, I don't enjoy disliking Doctor Who, but I can't help it at times. I think my problem is... Going back to what I was saying about social critiques, social criticism, I don't think you can seriously... I think the problem with this era is there's a huge distance between story concepts and story execution. Now, it may well be that these story scenarios that which the writers originally presented to Andrew Cartmell and JNT were ambitious social commentary. I don't know, I've not seen the original drafts of the scripts. But if they were, somehow this seems to get lost for me in the process of translating them to the screen.
Yeah, I would say that the social commentary and the satire, it's not graceful and it's not subtle, is it, generally?
No.
It's very laid on, but so I would agree with that point. But that didn't affect my enjoyment at all.
I mean, for example, I don't want to get into the Thatcher stuff.
Well, we've already said it, haven't we?
But there's all this... I was watching Happiness Patrol, and how shall I put it? Sheila Hancock's performance, it's an impersonation of Margaret Thatcher rather than any satirical parody.
It's no different to Gillian Anderson.
I mean, they talk about, oh yeah, we were writing it as you know, as a parody of Margaret Thatcher, and we were really impressed that Sheila Hancock picked it up straight away. You know, as if she's some kind of genius. It's hardly subtle. It's not even, if you think about it, a satirical critique of her government. There are passing mentions of miners and demos, but not much really. If you're going to try social commentary, do it by means of allegory. You don't say, I'm going to satirise the incompetent management of the coronavirus, so I'll write a story about a scruffy blonde Etonian politician screwing things up while his Eminence Grise drives 200 miles for an eye test. That's not satirical commentary, it's just a direct impersonation. It's a precy. Whereas, let's think. Well, ironically, given that we're talking about plagues, in La Peste, Camus shows us a plague decimating a town. And how are people reacting to it? And fighting it or not? How are they helping each other out or not? And you'll have to forgive me, we did this in French A-level 35 years ago, so my memory is dodgy at best, but one of the ways of looking at the novel is as an allegory of a political fight against fascism. You know, he's not saying, here I am, I'm writing a story about humanity's reaction to a plague in order to satirise that. He's saying, I'm using this in order to satirise something different where I think there's an allegorical connection. I mean, you could look at Davros as Boris Johnson. That whole laboratory scene of to hold in my hand a capsule that contained such power. You know, I'd happily wipe out all life in the universe just to be that powerful. That could be a rather abstruse allegory, or satire if you will, on Boris Johnson seeking the premiership for no other reason than just wanting to be in power. You know, he doesn't want to achieve anything with that power, he just wants to have it. That may be a little bit of a stretch. But at least it would be, you know, an allegory rather than an impersonation. Now, I'm not for one moment attacking Chris Clough for not being Albert Camus. But I am saying that if this era does have its weaknesses, don't try to defend the writer's room as a ferment of political commentary. What this reminds me, we've talked about Happiness Patrol particularly. It looks to me, you know, the two will know this, being two Ronnie's fans. It looks to me more like an episode of The Worm That Turned.
Yeah.
You know the where Britain is being run by women?
Yes, Diana Dawes.
And all men are dressed in dresses, yeah. And I think there's very much an element of Emperor's New Clothes in trying to get it to, oh, this is them trying to bring down the government.
But I think that's because they were young.
There's an inexperience here.
Oh, yes, I'm sure.
That's on the screen, and I think...
It's like we're working in telly. We've got this opportunity to do this. We're all young and we all feel this way. So let's...
If you watch The Writer's Room on the Season 26 Blu-ray box set, for that one, it's all of them sitting around going...
Which I didn't buy at the time. I'm absolutely kicking myself now.
Most of that's them saying, oh, I just wish if I'd have written it now, I would have done this, I would have done that. And that's half of the... you know, I thought it was a good thing that during the McCoy era that JNT wasn't having as much of an input as he had done in the past. However, because this was at a point where he had upset and angered so many people that they'd worked with in the past, that there were those, you know, like the Peter Grimwade never directed Doctor Who again going into the Colin Baker era because they had a big fallout. So obviously Eric Saywood had their acrimonious relationship. You know, there was a lot of that old guard had gone, which, you know, is good because there's a fresh brush coming in. But at the same time, there's a lot of inexperience. Yes, there's a lot of those older heads, you know, aren't around to maybe give a... Can you imagine Cartmel and this lot? Well, can you imagine the Cartmel and this lot working underneath, let's say, I don't know, Terence Dix script editing? I think it would be an amazing era. Amazing.
But Terence would probably wouldn't have brought them in, because Terence was... One of the things that I think makes the Pertwee era consistent is that Terence was using tried and tested Bob Holmes, Matt Hulk, even Barry Letson in disguise. Tried and tested people.
Barry Letson a beard, except that he's already got beard.
Who knew, by heart, how to do Doctor Who by numbers. And a lot of it was by numbers, and you wouldn't have got them.
I suppose with the reduced amounts of episodes and stories, it would be jarring if maybe once a year you did have someone like Terence Dix writing in there. It would have looked tonally, and everything would have been a bit off. But yeah, that's one of the downsides to having, you know, fresh young people in charge of this. Do you know what though? I mean, you've both said about how much you enjoyed. I really enjoyed watching the McCoy era again. I really did. I thought it was. It was just so enjoyable. I can't describe it any other way. But I wasn't surprised by that because, you know, I mean, I watched all of these about 10 years ago anyway. It seems to be a once in a decade thing now for me to go back and revisit all Classic Who. But genuinely, I put McCoy in my top five Doctors.
Yeah, I think me and Doc, you see, grew up and sort of...
Sorry, hang on a sec, Mark. Hello, Diddly Dub Podcast. Oh, Colin, hello.
No.
Yeah, Hayden did just say that he put Sylvester in his top five Doctors. No, don't worry, we won't say which of them comes fifth. Okay, thank you, sir. Sorry, what are you saying, Mark?
I think the different thing is, because me and Doc were there at the time... when this came on. So we've got a long built-up resentment towards this era.
In fact, it's interesting, isn't it, that Hayden watched them a few years after their broadcast, but as a child, didn't you, Hayden?
No, I only saw The Happiness Patrol when I was a child.
Oh, right.
Out of this run. The rest of it I've only seen either in my mid to late teens or adulthood.
But to be fair, that aged you. I do wonder at times, and especially with The Happiness Patrol, this is what makes me think this. Is it because it's the 1980s? Crappy style, crappy taste, crappy fashion.
Yeah. Oh, I think so. And I think if you were there at the time as well, you don't have that kind of, retro cool, like Rob Irwin said, that kind of being able to look back on it. It's like, oh, that era was kind of cool in a retro way. Because we were there and we hated it at the time and we know that. So I mean, haven't got that.
They do all look like cabaret acts in 3-2-1, don't they?
Mm.
You imagine that just before the Happiness Patrol women march on with their guns, that Ted Rogers is about to say, please welcome the Brian Rogers Connection.
I'm still not convinced you've watched anything except for the Happiness Patrol, Doc.
Oh, don't worry, I can start bitching about everything if you like. You see, I think at the heart of it is, I don't think the execution of these stories is generally done. With some exceptions, I don't think it's very competent. I think a lot of it is, it's a mess and it's quite incoherent. And that's what I say about here. You can have a writer coming up and say, here's my idea. But between that and getting it onto the screen, something happens. There's a comment that Andrew Cartmel makes, and I think it's in the Making of Ghostlight documentary, where he says, it probably isn't explained enough and too much got lost from the script. It's not deliberately obscure. I can assure you that all Doctor Who scripts do make sense, although they might appear bafflingly complex once they've been truncated and edited. Now, something that I think is interesting here is there's a sense for me is that as part of JNT's way of, you know, stretching the budget to accommodate more stories, you're getting these things where you end up with, you know, these three-part adventures instead of four-part ones. And what I'm thinking is the writer, let's say, presents a script for, say, a four-episode story, and they start cutting it down so that it can become a three-episode story, so that they'll get more bangs for their stories for their books. And I thought it was interesting that there are 6 three-episode stories in this era. Delta, Dragonfire, Happiness Patrol, Silver Nemesis, Ghostlight, and Survival. And I will say, possibly with the possible exception of Survival and maybe Dragonfire, I think what characterises most of those three-episode stories is that most of the time, I don't think I've got the slightest idea what's going on half the time. And I just think a lot of it is a great deal of nonsense. Whereas the four-episode ones, well, let's ignore Time and the Rani, but Remembrance is a four-episode one. Greatest Show in the Galaxy, Battlefield and Fenric are four-episode ones. And I don't think that's a coincidence. And I think what happens is, and really, and I don't want to say as if I'm being unkind to him, it ought to be the script editor's job to edit these stories so that the opposite is the case.
I know, yeah.
So you know, how many times do we hear Terence say, I got presented with this lousy script and I sat down one weekend, sorted it out, and we managed to get to the screen. And I do think that what happens with this deep social and political critiques that there are, I think it's used a lot of the time to excuse, never mind whether it's well done or not, feel the meaning behind it. Something like Paradise Towers. One thing you'll always see people saying is, oh, it's reminiscent of High Rise by J.G. Ballard. Now, while High Rise might be deep and biting social commentary on housing, that doesn't mean that a poorly made pastiche of High Rise achieves the same level of satire. And I wonder if what happens is that people will read, the writer of Happiness Patrol intended it to be inspired by High Rise, and so conclude that, oh, the satire must be there. So, you know, they take it for granted the satire is there, and they read it as that. But either the writer's reaching for social commentary, but at this stage in their career hasn't got the skill to pull it off, or it gets lost in translating the script to TV, or it's being exaggerated in order to excuse what I think is a lot of the time in these three series is just shoddy production values. Terence Dix was always saying, isn't he, stories have a beginning, and a middle, and the end. So many of these era stories seem to have a middle, and that's it. But let's hear how the listeners voted.
Okay, so in 12th place, with 1 point, is Time and the Rani. Very much the runt of the litter, isn't it?
Hmm.
And if the person who gave it that 1 point doesn't behave themselves for the rest of their lives, we'll reveal their identity.
Yeah, we've reviewed this one fairly recently, haven't we? So we don't need to go into too much detail. But with a lot of these, even when they're bad, I found lots to enjoy in them. And I remember when we were watching Time and Rani, I thought, oh, this could be a classic and maybe this is going to be really funny. And I remember finding it just far too, it just went on too long.
Forget camp classic, it was classic crap, I thought, when I watched it.
But I don't think you can blame Andrew C for it, because it's his first story. He was effectively landed with Pip and Jane Baker, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So it's kind of nice in a way for him that the bottom one in our poll, and most polls, probably isn't anything to do with him. So what's at number 11?
So in 11th place, with 12 points, is Dragonfire.
I actually did find this more entertaining than I remembered it. I get the impression, I've not actually looked this up, but I get the impression there are far more, shall we sort of say, stage actors on it.
Yes.
So you're getting lines that are being delivered with all the whumph they can be delivered with. One of the problems I think a lot of this era is delivery of lines. I don't think the acting is always particularly good, or the delivery of lines. whereas they really give them all, you know, all it's got here. Lovely multi-level set, most memorable white uniforms. I loved the bit at the beginning where Kane reaches into the liquid nitrogen to pick up the gun. That is glorious, that.
The effect towards the end when he melts?
Oh, yes, very...
Raiders.
Raiders, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, this one, I can see why it's... I'm slightly surprised it finished slowed down. For some reason, I thought it might finish higher up, but this is where I'd have had it in my top 12. I just found it a bit dull. I didn't get the same joy out of it that I got out of a lot of the other stories.
I actually got this out of the library as a kid, so this is only the second McCoy I've just remembered. This is the second of us McCoy I ever saw. And I honestly thought it wasn't too bad, but it's not a patch on the majority of this era, I think. So I think for me, I probably wouldn't have put it 11th. I probably would have put it something maybe a little bit higher, maybe like 9th or 10th. But
I mean, I even like Glitz on this.
Yeah, I like Glitz.
Glitz I like.
Well, I wasn't expecting to.
I have to say, I know it's early days for Sophie Aldred, and it does feel like it a bit.
Yeah.
The character of Ace doesn't really do a lot for me in this one. This is sort of like the peak, obviously, because she's just been introduced. Well, not necessarily the peak, but one of her big stories where I find that the middle-aged men writing her just make her seem mega naff.
Of course, goodbye to Mel as well on the days.
That's, of course, a nice farewell to Mel, that, actually.
Yeah, it is. It's a nice scene.
Yeah, a little bit of a throwback to almost to the Fourth Doctor and Sarah Jane
I thought that, yeah.
Doctor's just sort of carrying on doing stuff and going, right. And you know he's deliberately trying not to get emotionally involved in the moment, isn't he? Although by this point I was very pleased to, in my rewatch, I was very pleased to see Mel leaving because she's so painfully shrill when she screams that it just becomes unbearable. So yeah, that was...
She's a character and an actress in the wrong programme.
Yeah.
I think sadly for her, but anyway.
I think she professionally does what she does, but it doesn't fit.
Well, number 10 with 14 points is Silver Nemesis.
Oh, so these first three have all gone the way of my... I did the old story preference revealer.
Oh, yes, of course you didn't, yeah.
And so far this is matching perfectly, so because I had at number 10 Silver Nemesis, which comes as a surprise because I thought with the Cybermen here, it may have finished a bit higher.
I give Silver Nemesis 3B, Bobbins Beyond Belief.
Yeah. I've not got much to say about it, really. It's got a couple of nice set pieces. Ace on along the gantry on the top of the aircraft hangar is pretty good.
The main thing that I liked about it, and it's not necessarily a good thing, is that I found the Cybermen hilarious. And
oh, I know. They're arguing at one point, aren't they?
Yeah. And I just, to be honest, I do kind of like those Cybermen.
Oh, I like the shiny. The shiny, shiny.
Oh, no, but I like the ridiculous Cybermen in a way. There is a part of me that likes it. I mean, I'd prefer it if they were a bit more threatening and stuff. And that wonderful scene when they're trying to tune in and see if their signal's gone to the fleet and they're just standing there as this... smooth jazz plays out.
I know.
They're sort of looking around confused. It was fabulous. Yeah, it's a bit weird seeing Courtney Pine turn up, isn't it? Playing his very sort of middle of the road kind of tootling jazz and stuff. Yeah, and the bit where they stood outside the tomb, outside the mausoleum, whatever, saying, yes, Lady Painforth will go insane when she's confronted by the reality of her own death.
I
know. And they can just hear Lady Painforth laughing in there, and one of them says, is she mad now? The Cybermen goes, yes. There was stuff to enjoy in it, but
Previously on Diddly-Dum.
In Silver Nemesis, there's another example which comes to mind, which is Lady... There's a scene in the script. Well, let me tell you what you see on screen, first of all. On the screen, you see Lady Painforth in this little cottage, suddenly grabs a chair and smashes it through the window. Why does she do this? Answers on a postcard. The reason she does that is, in the script, it's very clear that as a person from, what's she from, the 17th century, 18th century, she doesn't know how to operate a modern door handle. And this is in the script, but it's not on the screen. So if you multiply that throughout a script, there's this accumulation of failed meaning. And that's one of the reasons that Silver Nemesis doesn't work. I mean, there's some problems with the special effects and so on, but I will defend that script on the page.
So, in ninth place with 15 points is Paradise Towers.
Ooh. Yeah, I have to say, I find a little more to enjoy about Paradise Towers than I did in Time and the Rani, but I don't enjoy it as much as Delta and the Bannerman. So I think for me, this would probably be bottom four too.
Yeah, it's very near the bottom for me as well. I think this is a very much one where you can really see the much commented on sort of influence of 2000 AD and stuff like that, because it's very, as well as being very J.G. Ballard, it's very Halo Jones, it's very Mega City One City Block.
Yes.
All those things. And yeah, I have to say, watching this, it didn't really ease my dislike. It eased my dislike of the era somewhat, but I mean, one of the things that blights this era for me generally is Kev McCulloch. And it's, I think I find some of his stuff in this just...
You mean the incidental music?
Yeah, the incidental music.
There's a lot of, especially in Delta, where you've got jaunty music at moments of great peril, haven't you?
Mm.
Seems a little unusual.
Yeah, but I enjoyed Pex, his entrance when they're just...
Oh, Pex is cool.
When Mel is sat there with the two resis and so he kicks the door in, smashes through the door.
Make the most of the peace and quiet. Yeah.
Are these old ladies annoying you?
No!
Are you annoying these old ladies?
No, she isn't!
Oh.
And I do wish you would stop breaking through our door to try and save us.
That's the third time we've had it repaired, and it's not as though we've ever been in any trouble.
Apart from bits of door flying about all over the place.
Look, who exactly are you?
The name is Pex. I put the world of Paradise Towers to rights.
And I thought he was a lovely character, actually.
What's in eighth place, Hayden?
In eighth place, with 25 points, is Delta and the Bannerman.
Oh.
Oh, Mark? Was that the Horn of Rassilon? Oh, it is, isn't it? Oh, Mark. Is this because it's Welsh?
No. Well, possibly. Hayden, when I showed you my top 12, you put a shocked face emoji beneath it. Was that because Delta and the Bannerman was at number 5?
I thought that might be too much of a hint, but yes, it was indeed. Yeah, I was quite surprised. Pleasantly surprised, but surprised nonetheless.
Yeah, this is the game changer for me, with the McCoy era.
Yeah, for me too, but...
Well, it went the other way, didn't it?
Yeah.
It's just, honestly, I put it at number 5 because I could quite happily rewatch this, because it's so utterly bonkers.
I won't deny that.
It's just, I was watching it, I have to say, I don't think I particularly enjoyed the first episode at the time. I'm not sure what emotion I had. I was so bewildered and confused. I couldn't really work out what was going on in my mind. I
couldn't stand confusion in my
mind. I'm trying to say exactly that thing.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's so outlandish in its... in its idea of like this Welsh 50s holiday resort and a busload of shape-changed aliens landing there by accident and having a holiday there, whilst one of them's an alien princess is being pursued by an armada of... I mean, it doesn't really make... I mean, it's such an odd story. It's got such an odd... It's almost Twin Peaks-like for me. When Billy stood on stage and the absolutely beautiful, lovely Ray stood there in front of him, and yet... Billy suddenly spots Delta in the crowd and is just transfixed by her. It's like it's skipped a beat. Like it's suddenly gone from
Oh, hi, I'm playing guitar. Oh, now I'm in love with that woman over there. And then later on when he's slurping up the royal jelly, the alien royal jelly, to turn himself into an alien. It's absolutely nuts. And all that 50s music. The thing is, I did think, it's also a story that I could imagine sitting down and watching with Polly. And I think that also affects my...
Possibly, yeah.
My judgment of it. Because I could definitely imagine us just sitting down with it and absolutely hooting our way through it.
I suspect that when Billy first saw Delta, he was imagining that she'd be the one who's slurping up the royal jelly, but... Well, I think it's nice you can like things like that. This could have been one. You know, we got such a lot of praise for our Nymon episode, and we thought, oh, damn, we can't think of another one where two of us think it's rubbish and one of us absolutely loves it. If you told us about Delta, we didn't think to suggest this one, Mark. We thought, Mark's daft, he's not that daft.
Well, it stunned me. I honestly was just... it stunned me how much I just totally fell for this story. It's so ridiculous that child painted green.
Yeah, it is.
It gets bigger. I mean, the production is pretty terrible. I mean, I love the horrible... Well, not the horrible, but the rundown holiday chalets and stuff. And it's just... I don't find it boring. I don't find it dull. I just find it... It is like Heidi High meets Doctor Who meets Twin Peaks. It's but set in a Wales Butlins.
Well, it does show that Doctor Who can do all genres, can't it? Doctor Who's done Hammer Horror... It's done heist stories, it's done whodunits. And clearly they wanted to show here, and we can do a cheap carry-on film as well.
But, I mean, it didn't start off well. I mean, Ken Dodd turns up, although he's certainly not the worst of the star bookings, is he, that John Nathan Turner makes. I'd say that was probably Richard Briers, wasn't it, actually?
Do you think Billy was cast solely because he could sing?
I don't know. Is that him singing? I don't know.
Well, I mean, he's a singer-dancer, I think.
Oh, right, okay, quite possibly.
Because you can't act.
Let's make this baby fly.
But there was one moment when Murray is driving the bus and just sat behind him is Mel, and they're all singing enthusiastically to the 50s rock and roll. And I just thought, this is an absolute flaming nightmare. I can't imagine being trapped on that bus. I would be out the emergency fire escape at the back, straight through that window.
You're almost willing Don Henderson to succeed, aren't you, at that point?
Well, just imagine if that was who was driving the bus. If that was the bus that was in Speed, I don't think it would have been such a successful film.
But I kept expecting the Bannerman leader to say, if the Rebel Alliance has got the hold of the plans, this battle station.
And I enjoyed his performance as well, just very cartoony.
Yeah, he's good in it, yeah.
I thought he was the best thing in it.
That bit where he's got a knuckle of raw meat in his hand and appears to be tearing bits off of his teeth. It's like, oh.
That's how they eat in Wales, I understand. But talking about incoherent storytelling, the worst, there has to be that scene where Delta's sitting in the chalet with her baby, her green baby. Billy walks in, doesn't even turn a hair.
No.
You know, she's hiding in there because the Bannermen are looking for her. And she and Billy decide it's a perfect opportunity
to go for a picnic.
At which point, Mel settles down to have a snooze. What the hell's going on?
I know. That is absolutely what I love about Delta and the Bannerman. It's completely absurdist theatre.
I think you see yourself as Garumwee, Mark.
Yeah, people's reactions aren't and behaviour is not realistic at all in it. I did start feeling like somebody had spiked my fizz aid with some sort of LSD.
I don't see the point of this. I don't think we should actually go through this in too great depth because...
No, that was just me blowing the horn.
We might do it one day. No, I didn't mean you, Mark. I meant me, because there was several bits I was going to say, but I don't think I'll... No, what did you think of Delta, Hayden?
I think I've already said my bit about it, haven't I? It's marginally better than... Well, no, it's better than Paradise Towers, but not quite as good as Dragonfire. It's sort of... Again, there's a lot to enjoy in it. Ray and the Doctor are at the dance, I quite like. But then there's quite a lot in it that I kind of wish was never committed to celluloid. But anyway.
It does make me sad. I mean, I do love Sophie Aldred, but because I know that they couldn't choose between Ace or Ray as the next companion, could they? And I do feel a bit wistful about that.
Oh, there we are. And so with that, we hit number 8, and having got through the bottom 5, we've now taken care of the whole of season 24. Silver Nemesis was the only thing in the bottom 5 that wasn't out of season 24.
If you add them up, Doc, how many points did season 24 amass?
Out of a possible 9... Well, everyone who puts in their votes for 5th place, 4th place, 3rd place, 2nd place, 1 place, effectively everyone gets 15 points. We had about 70 people put their votes in.
Oh, blimey.
The total number of points we totaled up to was 930. Season 24 got 53 of those, which is 5.7%. What do you think?
Yeah.
Oh, that's not unusual. You think, oh, there's only 3 series.
Wow.
What came 7th, Aidan?
7th, with 54 points, was Battlefield.
Oh, okay. I had that a bit higher.
I absolutely adore Battlefield. I absolutely love it. If you're interested in this era, or even if you want to become less hostile towards it, try reading Andrew Cartmell's great book, Script Doctor.
Oh, yes, I'm scared.
And there's a point in there where... Oh, no, I won't explain this because it's too going into too much detail. But, and this is one of those stories which, again, starts in the middle, i.e., there's a reason the Doctor's gone here. Or, if there isn't, then he's gone here unknowing that, you know, he's going to meet the results of something he's done in the future. So it starts in the middle. But the writing's so good that it doesn't make it bad.
Mm.
So it can start in the middle. It's just, I think, poor writing that messes it up. Love the Brigadier. Glorious things like that is confrontation with the Destroyer. I just do the best I can.
What do you want of me?
Get off my world!
Can this world do no better than you as a champion?
Probably. I just do the best I can.
I read people saying things like, this was really, really bad. That should have been the perfect scene for them to kill off the Brigadier. No!
No.
Kill off the Brigadier? No. Wonderful Jean Marsh chewing the scenery when she meets the Brigadier at that churchyard.
Oh.
And she says, how goes the day?
What manner of man are you? Oh, warrior, no less. How goes the day?
I've had better.
And, I quite love it, really. I like the new Brigadier, Sir Angela Bruce. I think she's really good. Just stuff like, you know, the curing the landlady's blindness, stuff like that.
Yeah.
No, I think it's glorious. Yeah, the silly armour and the broadswords apart. I really enjoy Battlefield.
Do you know, I'm a fan of it as well. I know Ben Aronovich thinks that he got quite a lot wrong with it, but actually, there's only two bits that stick out for me for being a little bit crap. One of them is when Morgaine's son laughing maniacally.
Oh, yeah.
And then it cuts a couple of scenes and it cuts back to him. He's still laughing maniacally. That bit's fairly naff. But really, apart from that, like I like the pub landlady being cured of her blindness, and yeah, to be honest, it's not a classic for me, and there is something missing from it that would really sort of make it. I think possibly the Brigadier comes a bit late into proceedings. He's in the helicopter quite a lot, but no, it's really enjoyable. I
love the line he says to his helicopter pilot. So, Bambera, good man, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, is there another bit towards the end that reminded me of the demons? Oh, yes, it's the bit where the all the women disappear off in Bessie for a joyride, And he turns to, the Big Deer turns to Anslin and says, are you any good with a lawnmower?
Yeah. Oh, it's like saying, do you fancy a paint, sir?
Yes. I loved all the Arthurian stuff in it, all those bits.
Yeah. Oh, I bet Polly would like that one.
Yeah, indeed. This really did nearly make it into my top five. It's just the barefaced cheek of Dalton the Bannerman that kept it out there. I enjoyed this. It is loads of fun. Paul Scoones, who does the... He's the guy who found...
Oh, yeah.
The lion.
Did you just strip for action? Or was that the comic, the book on the comics? Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yes.
He did the companion, yeah.
He does the information text for the collection stuff, the collection DVDs. He put up a link recently online on Twitter, a short blog he did talking about his research for the information text for this. And it's really interesting that the Braille book that the blind lady's reading at the beginning is actually Le Morte d'Arthur by Malory, which is a lovely touch, the fact that she went to the trouble of getting a Braille book. And also, Hayden referred to the bit where Mordred is laughing maniacally. You know, he stood in front of that octagon, like glowing octagon. It was supposed to be an eight-pointed star, not an eight-sided square. Oh, okay. But it somehow misread the script.
Oh, no.
It made me laugh. But, so, yeah, that's a really good reader. If you look at Paul Scoones.
I think he's a great, solid pillar of this era, Ben Aaronovitch.
Mm.
Yeah.
In our episode 16, podcast 16, back in 2014, when we had Andrew Cartman on the show, I don't think he'll be coming on again if he listens to this.
Oh,
I know he might too, actually. He'll say, "My God, I finally found someone who likes Delta." One of the things he presented to the museum was the original working script of Remembrance.
Let's talk about Ben Aaronovitch.
Okay, right. So this other...
Can I touch it?
Yeah, here you go. Careful. Right, this other script, this is next piece of history disguised as incomplete.
Sells the fags.
It certainly would, yes. That's absolutely correct. Ben was a chain smoker in those days. That's very true. He used to... I wouldn't let him smoke in my office, so he'd say, oh, I'm going down the corridor for a euphemism, like cigarette. And he'd go... And actually, I think that's probably helped him bond with John Nathan Turner, because they're both chain smokers in those days, so that's, they had that in common. So yeah, luckily Ben managed to kick that habit, but yes, he was a major smoker, and he used to I was going to try and describe what sort of t-shirts he used to wear, but I suddenly realized I couldn't name any of them. But yeah, he used to wear sort of black t-shirts, smoke fags, and hang around in the office. He's a good man and a genius, I'd have to say.
Mm-hmm. We haven't even talked about why you're giving us that script yet.
In a way, we've kind of talked all around that, but it's because Ben is such a great writer.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And I knew that. I got this... Ben sent in a spec script. That's that's when you write something purely on speculative, and you send it in and see if they like it. And he'd written a script called Nightfall, spelt with a K, like, you know, Knights in Armour, Knightfall. And I knew on the first page that this guy was great. I thought, oh, don't screw it up. And I remember reading the rest of it and thinking, yes, because it wasn't quite right, but it's obvious that he had what it took. He already had a science fiction sensibility. He was a great writer, a great script writer, which is not the same thing as being a great writer. It's a special discipline as well. And also, he had a feel for Doctor Who. It wasn't exactly the way we would later do it, but he had a good take on it. So yeah, he was the ultimate writer. He was just the guy I needed to meet at that time. It was fantastic.
Brilliant.
And he just enthused so much about working with Ben Aaronovitch. I think he's a real strength of this. Did he do just these two? Was it just Battlefield and Remembrance he did?
But you do get the feeling that they were all sort of building this series together, don't you?
Yes.
The writers and stuff. There was a lot more talking going on between them.
What were you saying about that writer's room documentary?
Oh, just how a lot of them are all saying how they could have improved on it this time around.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Their age that they are at now and their experience.
I must watch that. What's it like? Is it...
It's good. It's very good.
Are they actually all in the room together, or are they just being interviewed on one-on-one?
No. They're all in a pub together having pub lunch.
And in sixth place with 70 points is The Greatest Show in the Galaxy.
Yeah, I think for me here, this is where, personally, I probably would have put Battlefield in my top six in sort of my higher half of McCoy.
Hmm.
But I think Greatest Show for me is very strong. It comes at a point, well, it's the last story in season 25, and I think for me it's a real pivot towards that sort of darker Doctor. I know there's hints of it in Remembrance and Happiness, of course, but I think for this is really the turning point for me where I kind of watch it and I half expect to see the Doctor in his brown jacket to distinguish him as, oh no, this is me being serious now.
Yes, yeah.
I know you got the scene with the gods of the Ragnarok and everything towards the end of part four, but I find the clown incredibly sinister.
The chief clown?
The chief clown, yeah. Yeah. He's incredibly sinister. Captain Cook's a bit... he's okay. Yeah, and Mags is almost a companion that we never had.
Well, I think that that it starts off and basically T.P. McKenna's captain and Mags are basically the Doctor and companion.
Yes, they are, yeah.
Except
good parallel.
He's become incredibly complacent and I think even the way he keeps saying, well, when I was in such and such and I was doing, I remember when I was on this planet doing this with these things. And that's very John Pertwee.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And, it is.
You know. It's definitely, I mean, obviously, I know it's much commented on, but there's an awful lot of meta stuff going on, isn't there?
There is, yeah.
Which I do really like the stuff with WizKid. I think it's quite brutal. It's quite a brutal mocking of Doctor Who fans.
Is WizKid the little boy with the bow tie?
Yes, that's right. He's the sort of Harry Potterish, Adrian Mole kind of chap.
I've always classed this with Paradise Towers, Delta, and Happiness Patrol ones that I roundly dislike. But what I find more irritating is not the fact I dislike them, but the fact that people will say, "Oh, there's so much depth here." But I watched this again the other day, and I thought, "Oh, I didn't dislike it as much as I thought I would." I don't think I've not watched it that many. I think I've only probably watched it twice before ever. It didn't particularly get me, but it's during this process in the last week or so of rewatching the whole of the Sylvester era, the best way of perhaps giving a score to it was how many times I kept nodding off in the middle of it and having to wake up and rewind it. I didn't that many times during Greatest Show in the Galaxy. I thought a lot of it was quite, you know, clowns, obviously, they're going to, that's obvious to be scary for, isn't it?
Yeah.
I did find the Gods of Ragnarok a bit rubbish. And when Sylvester does his,
I have fought the Gods of Ragnarok all through time!
I thought, oh, really? When?
Yeah, so did I.
It's very Avengers, isn't it, in a way? You know, he's got a circus, then in the middle of a beach somewhere, and they found an old bus with a robot conductor on it.
Yeah.
Avengers in the sense of Steed and Mrs. Peel, I mean, not...
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I think this is an example of the more you progress into Sylvester's era, his acting improves immeasurably.
Yeah.
That's not to say that it ever becomes good. It ever becomes brilliant. But I think it starts out quite pantomime-ish in Time of the Rani. And what happens is, I don't know whether if his acting gets better, therefore he starts doing this, or they start writing him like this, and therefore his acting comes across, because this is one of his strengths, is when he calms down and he's quite quiet and still, and all the declamatory stuff of...
I have fought the Gods of Ragnarok all through time!
And he's just doing, you know, quiet little things. He's so much better. Mm. And I do think that the rolling of the R's, which he never quite abandons, I mean, it becomes much less prevalent. Mm. But it's almost like the Collins coat of the Sylvester era.
Yeah.
The rolling of the R's just immediately reduces the impact of anything he's saying or doing. Just as you can have Colin, you know, he can have a really deeply, dramatically emotional moment. But in that coat, you can't entirely take it seriously. It reduces the dramatic impact of what he says or does. Because they both scream artificiality. In fact, they both scream JNT, don't they? The air of the pantomime can't be avoided. But when Sylvester is... I don't think it's a coincidence. He does this mostly during Ben Aaronovitch's stories and the later stories. Yes, admittedly, in Battlefield, he does the... what's that line he does where he does his shouty acting in the middle of the sword fight?
There will be no battle here!
And it just comes across really lousy. And it's it reminds me a little bit sometimes of when Matt Smith was doing his shouty acting. You know, he gets on top of the Stonehenge and starts shouting at all the ships above. And it doesn't work at all. But when he's calm and more considered and quiet, he's much, much better. And what were we talking about there? That was a great show, wasn't it? This, of course, is one of the things of this blaxploitation thing, isn't it? I was only joking with that. But the Black Ringmaster, by coincidence, just happens to talk in rap.
Yeah.
People have said, you know, this is a bit, you know, it's a bit cliche.
I have to say that was one of the bits that I didn't like at all. That I thought, oh God, I'm going to hate this story. When it opened up and the Ringmaster comes out and starts...
The greatest show in the galaxy.
And suddenly you hear a record scratching in the background going... Quick, 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 quick. And it's like, oh no, he's not, is he? And it's just things like that do come across as incredibly naff, and they were at the time as well. I remember, because it was like I you watch stuff like that, and again, it's that thing of, this is what's cool, isn't it? And it's like, no, it's, you know, yeah, I don't think that's aged well, that bit.
What came in fifth place, Hayden?
In fifth place with 76 points is the Happiness Patrol.
Oh.
Which we, I think, well, 3/4 of us seemed to quite enjoy, didn't we? When we covered it last year.
Yeah, let's not spend too long on this one.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about Happiness Patrol earlier in the show, didn't we?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, well, hang on. One thing I ought to say, sorry, because we've gone through these, is that Dragonfire I put in fourth place. And Battlefield, I put in third place for me. And Hayden, you put Happiness Patrol in fourth place.
Yeah.
And Mark puts it in third place.
Yes, yeah.
And in fourth place, with 95 points, given fifth place by me and third place by Hayden, probably fifth place by me, mainly because I had to give something fifth place. I didn't exactly hold my nose, close my eyes, and stick a pin in it, but I almost did. Is Survival.
Oh, well, which you haven't mentioned where I put it.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, well, no, because I've done all of them, haven't I? I put it ninth.
Oh.
It's because I don't find there's any fun in this story at
all. No, neither do I, but it's not bad.
No, but I found it really unsettling and quite disturbing. I've said before on the horror podcast how it's that thing of people being possessed and stuff. I mean, it's not quite possession here, is it? Ace isn't really getting possessed, but it's her humanity is disappearing. Ace is disappearing and just the animal instincts are coming out. And I don't know why. I find it really incredibly dark and it really bothers me. I found this a really uncomfortable watch for some reason. I'm not sure what that says about me, but there we go. And also, I couldn't bear that bloke turning up in his awful 80s clothes and black sunglasses at the village hall. And
oh, Mitch. Trust.
Yeah.
Mitch.
And the cats.
Although in the making of documentary, he looked quite a giggle.
Oh.
Oh, I tell you, have you been watching the making of documentaries during this?
No.
The actor who played Anselin in Battlefield is a scream. He clearly had a whale of a time. He's taking the piss throughout the making of documentary.
Yeah, I did see him and the lady who played Flower Child at the convention that I went to up on the Wirral a couple of years ago.
Who at the Hoy Lake? Oh, that outtake of Sylvester McCoy losing his shit when they're not staying still is hilarious.
Oh, when he throws his umbrella over his shoulder. That is his best scene ever, that, isn't it?
That's brilliant, that. The only things that let this down for me...
Cats.
Is the cuddly makeup on the cats, but it's also... And Mitch trying to act all hard. But that, apart from that, I think is really... Also, it's Anthony Ainley's best appearance as the master since Legopolis as well.
Yeah.
I think. Where he's actually very toned down, very sinister, and not in control. It's an interesting sign of things to come for the master, I'd say.
Well, I'll give you that.
What came in number three, Hayden?
And number three with 155 votes, so this is a huge jump up.
From 95, yeah.
Yeah, is Ghostlight.
Fourth place for Mark and fifth place for Hayden.
Yeah, I only just squeaked it.
And I think this is the reason why Survival got fifth place from me, because I could not live with myself if I'd given any points to Ghostlight, Happiness Patrol, Greatest Show, Delta. Actually, yeah, Greatest Show, I probably could have done. I didn't mind that so much. Ghostlight, fire away, Hayden.
I think it's really good, but it would be better if I understood what the bloody hell it was about.
Now, I hear this complaint quite a lot. And again, this is one that I don't think I've actually seen all the way through before. And so when I sat down...
That helps for understanding it.
To watch this, I still don't feel like I've seen it all the way through. No,
yeah.
No, I'm joking.
I think whoever wrote the script will probably tell you haven't.
Yeah, Mark Platt, yes. I didn't find it quite as bad as I expected, as I've been led to believe. I could just about work out what was going on.
Ace is a lot easier to take seriously out of her street kid clothes, isn't she?
Yes, she's great. And I thought this episode really felt like a Sapphire and Steel episode.
Yes. Story. Yes, isn't it? So with ghosts walking through walls would be, wouldn't it?
Mm. Yeah. I thought it's got that real sort of Sapphire and Steel vibe. No, I loved this one.
Really?
Yeah.
Because this is
the
one where I think Andrew Kirkman was as good as admits that cutting it down to three episodes, which... It was left in this condition where no one understood it until they made a DVD documentary about it 30 years later.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be interested to see that, because I do think I understand it. There's Light is, for whatever reason, is trying to do a survey of planets and life on them. And he comes to Earth and he's trying to do a survey and he creates Control, which is supposed to be... He's trying to understand evolution, so he creates Control, who he keeps in that state, and then he creates another being, who becomes Josiah, who he allows to evolve.
Yeah.
And then, as he's trying to understand evolution, he gets infuriated that things don't stay the same. He's got to keep recataloguing them, and decides he's had enough, he's going to destroy the Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose so.
It's quite clear from the DVD extras that not only the cast, but also the director didn't have the first idea what the story was about. The director's telling stories about. They're at the Acton Hilton doing the rehearsals. The cast are asking him questions, or what does this mean? And he's nipping out to the payphone in the corridor to ring the writer and ask him. And you think, I'm not sure that's gone too well.
Oh, well, probably, because I imagine, especially if you're doing it in a script and you're just acting bits out, you won't be doing it in linear form either. So it must be really hard to understand what's going on just from a couple of pages of script and, like, here's a scene.
Sylvester's very much stopped his declamatory stuff and his rrrring.
Greatness.
Mm. I don't think I could ever forgive any story for the white kids firebomb Manisha's flat.
Oh, yeah.
And you just went, oh, f*** her face. Because... That is just the sort of thing. You see, Ace is wearing a bomber jacket, Doc Martens, and carrying around a baseball bat. If she really was an urban street kid, she'd be the one who's firebombing Manisha's flat, wouldn't she? She'd be the one who's sympathising with her.
Well, she did firebomb Gabriel Chase, didn't she?
Yes, that's true. Gabriel Chase sounds like a Manhattan bank. In second place, first place for Mark... And second place for me, both Hayden and myself, with 198 points, and another great leap from the last one. In second place is The Curse of Fenric.
Well, this is basically, this top three has gone exactly how I thought it would, to be honest. I think a lot of people commented, didn't they, after they put in their first three, that they were really struggling with four and five. Because there wasn't any they really liked. So there's a lot of people who obviously felt the same about the Sylvester McCoy era that I used to. before I had my damaging conversion.
I honestly think when I watched this again, this was really close to being my top. Possibly because I've seen Remembrance more, and this time around it just felt fresher, and because I've read the novel as well a couple of years ago, which is great as well. I think there's a genuine claim to say that The Curse of Fenric could possibly be in the top 20 best Doctor Who stories of all time, to tell you the truth. I think it's brilliant. It's really, really well-told story. It's really well realised. It's incredibly well acted. Nicholas Parsons as the Reverend is astonishing.
Yes.
Extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah. Really, really good. And the whole, you know, Hemavore vampire connotations and the Fenric, you know, this sort of long game. The first time Doctor Who's done a story arc since the last time he did a story arc. And seeing it played out over season upon season, you know, it's brilliant. I love Fenric. I think it's a brilliant story. There's not really much else I can say about that. There's not very many faults, and nothing really comes to mind right now. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, this was probably the first McCoy that I'd have watched in like over 20 years when I reviewed it, when we reviewed it for the podcast. And I was surprised and delighted to find that it was way better than I could hope for.
Came in 30th place in DWM's Mighty 200. Which is quite a lot down, isn't it?
What do you think?
No, not really. 30th place. Ooh, yeah. No, I think that 30, when you consider all the classic stories and how many, I think 30 is no shame at all. I mean, look where Horns of Nymon is.
Oh.
So, you know.
Again, different clothes for both of them. I adore Professor Judson turning into Fenric. He played a contest against Time Lord.
Oh, yeah.
Don't quite understand the logic behind the how he wins the chess set. The black and white pawns don't fight each other, they join forces. So Fenric, for all these centuries, has been struggling. Oh, how do I win this chess game? And he's like, oh, I just cheat. Not entirely sure why they're there. Have they gone there to face up to Fenric or to fix Ace's mother problems?
It's the Doctor manipulating, isn't it? Yeah. He's taking her to all the places where he's...
I do get a slightly uneasy feeling with Ghostlight and with Curse of Fenric, with the Doctor's sort of... I know he's trying to do it for the good of Ace, but it feels quite close to abuse, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's the only problem I have with it.
Oh, hang on, someone left a window open.
Oh, that might be me.
I can feel the wind through my clothes.
I don't. Okay. Yes, I can think of a negative in this story now. Thanks, Doc.
I'm glad I'm here in Paradise Tower, so I can't hear the wind coming through Doc's clothes. The other thing I was going to say is that Sophie Aldred, I'd like to make a special point that I think especially in Fenric and Ghostlight, and indeed a lot of these, as she goes along, she gets better and better. And I think some of her, not all of it, because I think occasionally she's given stuff that's still a bit sort of teenage cool Ace stuff to do. And that always grates with me. But when she's playing a sort of more worldly wise Ace, which suits Sophie Aldred much better, I think some of her performances are absolutely brilliant. So rewatching these all in a row, she's definitely gone up as well in my estimation as a companion.
And in first place, a story which I think came 14th in the DDM Mighty 200, voted in first place by Hayden and myself, and in second place by Mark, but he's always been an iconoclast, Mark. It's, of course, I'm sure you can work this out, Mark, what is it?
It's Delta and the Bannermen.
It's Remembrance of the Daleks.
Yeah.
With 215 points, which is a slight jump from... Delta at 25.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, actually, when you look at it, you know, Remembrance of the Daleks got 215, and season 25 overall got 375.
Yeah.
So it got a hefty chunk of that vote.
Yeah, for me, it was a bit of a struggle between this and Fenric to see which came first.
Yeah, to be honest, I found it difficult as well. Not an easy choice, is it? So.
What tipped the balance for me was Michael Sheer kneeing Ace in the guts.
Polite way of putting it.
I think what tipped it for me was watching it this time round, and I think picking up on some of the social commentary a little more than maybe I did before. So, like the sign in the window.
No Trekkies.
Yeah, no Trekkies. That bit. No Babylon 5 fans here.
No Trumpers. Which would have meant something very different in 1963.
And I have to say, you know how I think we spoke in the past, I think about, was it Enemy of the World when we said, oh, when this was discovered? Of course it was always going to be a bit of a hidden gem because of the people working on it. You know, because you've got the likes of David Whittaker writing it, Barry Letts directing it, and it was the last one to be produced by Sidney Newman. Well, Remembrance of the Daleks has, of course, in its midst, it has not only Michael Sheard, but it has Peter Halliday as well.
Packer?
Yes, Packer as the blind vicar.
I didn't realise that.
And I only realised it this time round. How blind am I? But, I didn't believe that. That's okay. Oh dear. This is a Stone Cold, well, this and Fenric are both Stone Cold classics. Just brilliant. Again, we've looked at this one in depth, haven't we, in the past? Mm. But I think this is such a good story.
Yeah.
This was mostly filmed round about where my office used to be.
Mm.
So that's interesting. I think it always looks familiar when I see it, particularly the bits where they're messing around with the special weapons Dalek. I must say, what does it for me on this is everything other than the Daleks, because I find the Daleks tedious beyond belief these days.
Ooh.
I mean, they don't do anything for me. Probably because all the, you know, just they'll give the Dalek one word or one phrase and have them repeating it repeatedly. Just does nothing for us, repeatedly, you know what I mean? Does nothing for me. So all that nonsense was, the fighting, where Race is fighting the Daleks. Right, but as actual characters, the Daleks don't do much for me, nor does bloody Davros.
But here, as something for Ace to perform against,
yes,
they're fantastic.
Again, possibly Sylvester's greatest moment and Sophie's. Sylvester's The Ripples speech. Ripples in the sugar, ripples in the coffee, whatever he was talking about. Calm, quiet, just contemplative, rather than anything else. And in fact, you get two points here, almost at different ends of the story, where the woman who looks like Barbara says, oh, it's a death ray. And Chunky says, a death ray? That's unbelievable. Well, yeah, of course, it's 1963. Of course a death ray is going to be unbelievable to someone. And the doctor does his sort of, what a predictable response. Which I think is, when he delivers lines like that, it just turns me off him completely. But he almost says something similar a bit later on. He says, weapons, always useless in the end. But he says it in a sort of ruminative way, not a contemptuous one. You know, it's contemplative. And it works really, really well.
A death ray. Really. It's unbelievable. What a predictable response. Weapons. Always useless in the end.
Which almost makes up for the grave error of judgment line. And Ace's best moment is the no colours thing. That's a lovely moment for Ace, that.
Mm.
Not remembrance also for me is a revelation, wink, for Ace as well. Because I thought for a long lot of time, I used to think Ace, oh, she's an annoying, bolshy teen. I wasn't very keen on her. But remembrance was the one that made me think, actually, oh no, she's quite a good character. You know where she turns over the sign in the window?
Oh. Yeah,
and I thought when she sees, oh god, she's going to storm into the kitchen and tell, you know, Mike's mother, oh, what's this bilge bag? Well, all she does is she just looks at her, and then she just very calmly puts it down. You see everything in the expression in her face.
Exactly, it's her face.
And I think you said, didn't you? I've seen you. I've either read you or seen you say somewhere that didn't someone at the BBC suggest to you, oh no, she should have angrily torn it up?
Mark Sheevis, I'll tell you this story because it's unforgettable. What used to happen is we'd used to send our scripts upstairs to the head of drama, And they would never interfere. But if there was, theoretically, if there's anything that they objected to, they would object at that stage or after the thing was shot, when it was edited and we basically had the broadcast version ready to go, we would show it to the powers that be. And there again, this was their chance to intervene at script stage and at edit stage, right? So Mark Sheavis was the head of drama, head of series and serials at that time. And so we went up to Mark Sheavis's office. And what we used to do is we used to sit on the sofa, stick the VHS, for it was a VHS in those days in the machine. So me and John would sit there on the sofa, and Mark Sheavis would sit behind his desk of power, and the episode would play. Actually, he would come out from behind the desk of power and sit with us and watch it. Okay, so we had that episode, and I was so proud of that episode. I was so proud of that scene, No Colors. And just as that scene was coming up, Mark Sheavis' phone rang. And he went and he talked, yak, right through the scene. The scene's over. The scene's ancient history. The scene's in the rearview mirror. Mark Sheavis completes his phone call, comes back, sits down, and I made him rewind it. Like, there's no way he would have watched, you know, he didn't want to watch Doctor Who at all, let alone, you know, have to watch the bit that he missed. He was probably thanking God for that phone call, so he didn't have to watch the whole bloody episode. So I made him rewind and watch it. So, of course, he couldn't just stand for that. He had to make a comment. He said, oh, well, that doesn't quite work. I feel that it would have really have worked if she had torn up the sign. And me being just this young, impressionable script editor, I thought, oh, my God, we missed a trick. She should have torn up the sign, but I talked to Ben about it. Years later, he said, no, that would be overdoing it.
Lots of exciting action, though. Same as in Battlefield.
Yeah, definitely.
And so, of the 930 points to be distributed, Season 24 picked up 6% of them. Season 25 picked up 40% of them. And Season 26 picked up 54% of them. Which I think is telling.
Mm.
One thing we looked at last time was, given that everyone has 15 points to distribute, did anyone get it bang on? Did anyone's choice exactly match the final results?
No.
So,
Did they?
Did anyone's 15 points all land in the top five? And there were quite a few. There was Tim Gambrell, friend of the show, Mr. Simon Brett.
Oh, right.
There was Stephen Horriak, at Shed Stephen, Plester Rourke, and at Steed Styling, and typically Aidan Bloody Gribble.
Really?
He always gets everywhere, doesn't he? Yeah.
Do you know, I'm very surprised, I have to say, because some of my picks I genuinely didn't think would get in the top five this time around. Well, I think in the past, I think like with the Tom Baker we did, and five of mine fell in then. I mean, they were fairly standard, I suppose. But I'm surprised this time out, because there is quite a lot of variety with McCoy fans.
Mark got 14 of his points in the top five. If you'd only swapped Delta for Survival Mark, you'd have been in the top 15.
Never.
But someone actually got the exact top five in the right order that the results were. And that was none other than that venerable British institution, who some people have said should be pulled down and replaced by a brutalist concrete block of flats, and who has survived largely thanks to the tireless efforts of the Council for the Preservation of Bearded England. It's Mr. Sucky Kirk.
Oh, well done, Sucky. Oh. Well done, Sucky.
Yay.
So, just before we go on to some listener comments, I'll just generally talk about Sylvester and Sophie. I don't think it's that unfair to leave Bonnie out, because she's effectively leaving.
I mean, I always felt like she was... I mean, like I said earlier, she was in the wrong programme. I just think from the start, you can tell... You know, she's given it her all. You know, she's enthusiastic about it. She's clearly having a whale of a time, but doesn't quite work. But I think the Sophie Aldred and Sylvester McCoy dynamic, he's one of the best. Because their characters are fairly well written. They develop together as well.
Yeah.
And there's a likability about them both being together, and they're iconic.
Yeah, I'd say it's a perfect match. And I think perhaps because the seasons are so short,
you don't get tired.
Yeah,
of it.
Exactly.
It's not like you're thinking,
mm.
"Oh, I wish they'd be with." You know, you don't want them to separate. To be honest, mm. In a way, it's a bit like the Fourth Doctor and Sarah Jane. Part of you wants them to go on forever, and in a way, they kind of did for a while, didn't they? So,
yes, indeed.
I think I'm a big fan of Sylvester and Sophie, less so of the Seventh Doctor and Ace. And I think it's possibly something that feeds into the problem I have with all post-Legopolis stories of the classic era. I think the first four Doctors each has an undeniable charisma. Tom and Pat, certainly. John, yes. And even Bill quickly develops that twinkle, doesn't he? But I think that after Tom leaves, that starts diminishing. I don't think that Peter, Colin or Sylvester give us especially charismatic Doctors. Peter, to some extent, I don't think Colin or Sylvester.
I disagree. I think it definitely starts coming back with Sylvester.
Oh, really?
I think it does, yeah. Me. I agree.
Peter is arguably on a sticky wicket with his TARDIS team as he's travelling with a moaning Minion Tegan who just doesn't want to be there, spoiled Kitty Nadrick, who irritates him, sorry Mark, and Missa just walks around with a stick up her ass and she's saying very little. There's no one for Peter to form a warm relationship. His most interesting relationship is probably with Turlough.
Mm.
But even then, that's someone who's mostly plotting to kill him. So there's not much warmth there. Colin plays a Doctor who's full of himself and even opens by trying to strangle Perry.
Yeah.
Now, there is a warmth between Sylvester and Sophie, but I find there's an artificiality to his performance. Not all the time, but too much of the time, which, for me, precludes him being a charismatic Doctor. Yes, you do see it in moments like the sugar scene in the cafe, but that's almost like a light switch charisma. Sometimes it gets turned on and off, turned on, and you can guarantee in the next scene it's probably more likely to be reverting to his a slightly over-the-top style. And then you have what I said about the rolling of the R's, which just takes me out of the story completely.
Yeah.
I mean, he's actually got a Scottish accent, so he doesn't need to do that. Ace, I think, she discusses in the DVD extras for Survival whether her voice, and so does Sanju Kato, whether her voice should have been, her accent should have been more, you know, street kid than it is. Because what's interesting is, and Andrew Cartman almost says this, I think, as a way of defending how this is genuinely what kids on the streets, teenagers on the street were like in those days, in that she's being written as a fusion of three 16-year-old girls that they knew in a drama group. Well, I mean, the people who are like a drama group are all the Kangs, aren't they? Who just look as if they're in an Am-Dram session somewhere. She's just got a fair amount of character development. Lord, I think it's almost worth them cancelling the series to stop her actually becoming a Time Lord.
Yeah, I'm not.
And I don't think too much of it is her performance. I think a lot of it is in the lines she's given. They have suddenly flashes of anger, which seems artificial. They say in Ghostlight, oh, is this an awful planet? And she's standing there just looking quite nervous. And there's the Doctor, and she suddenly flashes, if you don't like it, bog off. And it looks like, oh, God, they put that in because they thought, oh, we must have a line for Ace here. Let's put one of her lines in. A ridiculous thing she says in Fenric. Oh, what a beautiful baby. What's its name? Audrey. Oh, I hate that. It's my mum's name. I hate it. Such a middle-class concept of an angsty teen. But, nothing to do against her. I just find it, look, if you're going to have someone like that, then write it properly. But having said all that, it isn't a case of hate for this era for me. I recognise that the writers and the script editor were young newcomers looking to be adventurous and edgy, and being faced with JNT's budgeting policy, you know, trying to cut down four episode stories down to three. And I do like Andrew Cartmell a lot. He's a very interesting man, very generous with his time. Even if he did once describe my writing as bearing all the hallmarks of a rank amateur. Shall we have a look at some of the listener comments then? David Kitchen has written and saying Survival is, he thinks, is the best story of the 80s.
No.
The tone, ideas, visuals, music, cast, the master, all the natural peak of 80s Doctor Who. Dragonfire is an underrated and fun story, and I should also mention my other top five McCoy stories from my era of the show. One, The Highest Science. I think these are books, aren't they? Two, Time Worm, yeah. Exodus. Three, Nightshade. Four, Bad Therapy. Five, Blood Heat. And six, Frontier. That's six of them.
Well, I shall take notes, because I might dip into those.
Dan Pin's one of our new favourite listeners. Your podcast is a new discovery for me. Loving working my way through your back catalogue. Don't know if that's meant to be a euphemism. Ian Key says, to be honest, I'm not the biggest of McCoy fans. Prefer some of his novels and audios. His three seasons always seem to be lacking something. Deborah at Flightless Crow. I'm tempted to move Silver Nemesis up, but it's probably the Seventh Doctor story I enjoy the most, but I also recognise that it's objectively nonsense. So this is my compromise. I think that's why I like Delta so much. It's obviously nonsense, but a lot of fun all the same. A soulmate for you, Mark. Sucky says, today's mood meant that Survival and Happiness Patrol went into fourth and fifth spot. Tomorrow's mood might have been Dragon, Silver Nemesis, Battlefield, Paradise, whatever. 42 to Doomsday Boys gave us their top five, but then recommended, but make sure you read Search Out Science. So I'm not entirely sure what that meant. Tarek Latif for Fantastic Era, the Seventh Doctor's Era. And then finally, from friend of the show, the human panel and dome, Mark Cockrum. Watching season 24 on first broadcast when I was 14 was deeply embarrassing. I had to watch it on my own because it was so cringeworthy. After the first couple of stories, I stopped watching. The trailers for Remembrance had me intrigued enough to give it a go, and I was pleasantly surprised at the rise in quality from the previous year. And by the time season 26 came along, I was really enjoying watching the show again, which made the cancellation all the more upsetting. Sylvester has grown on me in the intervening years, and I think the character of Ace was a step in the right direction in terms of getting a companion who had something resembling an arc and character development. Overall, it's a marked improvement on Colin's run, with some really interesting story ideas, which eventually rejuvenated the programme for a new generation of fans.
And so say all of us.
So before we go, Hayden, can you pick out the next Doctor's Era we're going to do from your hat, please?
Okay, so I'm just sorting through it, picking out a piece of paper, and okay, well, interesting. That's a new series, Doctor.
Oh!
One that we haven't looked at much in recent times. It's Matt Smith, lads.
Yay! Oh, good. Do you know what?
Matt Smith. What do you think of that, Uncle Terence?
Oh, he's very, very good. He's Matt Smith. Just a bit too young, and he's a bit weird, isn't he?
Right. Though any of you know where all the Matt Smith's bodies are buried, let us know, and we'll invite your vote soon. Talking of bodies, Uncle Terence.
Yes, don't dump them into the river. Do not dump bodies into the river.
Uncle Terence, we have enemy ships in Sector 27.
It's a trip.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dum. On Twitter at @diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. It is liquid podcasting, fitted in your ear.